This evening, I'd like to offer some reflections on unbinding the heart. This is a phrase which in the early texts of the Buddha's teaching, it's a phrase that's often used quite interchangeably with renunciation. Just to point out that you would not find the phrase let go in the early texts, which is often how we're tempted, I think, to translate or to hear renunciation, because it sounds a little bit more palatable, doesn't it? On some level, let go, or letting go, much more gently, rather than renunciation, which I think often for many people has this kind of, sense of coldness or harshness to it. But of course, in the early teachings of the Buddha, it's very important to remember that renunciation truly was offered and taught as a practice and a path of both happiness and freedom, that there was nothing at all cold about it. So I'd like to begin with a poem that some of you may be familiar with by Naomi Shihab Nye, called Adios. It's a good word, rolling off the tongue, no matter what language you were born with. Use it, learn where it begins, the small alphabet of departure. How long it takes to think of it, then say it, then be heard. Marry it, more than any golden ring. It shines, wear it on every finger. Up to your hands dance, touching everything easily, letting everything easily go. Strap it to your back like wings or a kite tail, the stream of air behind a jet. If you are known for anything, let it be the way you rise out of sight when your work is finished. Think of things that linger, leaves, cartons, and napkins, the damp smell of mold. Think of things that disappear. Think of what you love best, what brings tears into your eyes. Something that said adios to you before you knew what it meant or how long it was for. Explain little. The word explains itself later, perhaps. Lessons following lessons, like silence following sound. I have a dear friend who, every time she takes a flight, she worries. Part of her really acknowledges that it's logical to worry about this most illogical thing to do. So she worries. And she knows how painful it is to worry. And she tells herself every time she flies that she really should let go of this worrying. But then another part of her says to herself, but after all, someone needs to worry. Because who knows, it might be what's keeping the plane airborne. And what would happen if nobody worried? You know, maybe nobody would be safe. I love this kind of report she gave me, because it struck me how much it describes our human dilemma. That we actually all know the painfulness of clinging, grasping, that there's very little happiness present in any moment of clinging. The outcome is almost always the same, delivering a quality of contractedness and anxiety that often feels to blight our lives. And we know how much that quality of contractedness also leeches joy from our lives. And I suspect that there's many in this room who've told themselves many, many times to let go. Have you noticed how deeply ineffective that command is? But we keep doing it. In the midst of our obsessions and our contractiveness, we pick up a new command, which is let go. And it is more interesting to actually, I think, examine the underlying belief systems in holding and grasping. We may tell ourselves that it is our clinging or our grasping to people, to things, to situations that somehow keeps people close to us. We may have an underlying belief system that it is clinging or grasping that will somehow serve to protect us from loss and from our world's crumbling. We may see that clinging and grasping in a way protects others and ourselves in some unknown way. We may even at times mistake clinging for connectedness. I think there's a simple reality that all of us will in our lives be asked to let go of things, to unbind our hearts countless times in our lives if we are to live this life fully. And it is a life in which many things are letting go of us. The Buddha proposed a very simple formula that clinging and grasping and holding are experiences laced with suffering that lead actually to greater suffering, and that the degree of freedom and peace and happiness in our life is equal to the degree that we find in ourselves a capacity to unbind, to be able to release, our capacity for relinquishment. In the Buddhist tradition, liberation is taught in a very uncompromising way, in which unbinding, relinquishing, renunciation occupies a very pivotal and central place. That the path, it also taught that the path of happiness and the path of freedom, described as renunciation, is also a very profound gesture of self-compassion. And it's a gesture of compassion for all beings, for our planet, and for the world. We speak a lot about intention in the path of awakening and in the path and meditative paths. And in many ways, when the Buddha speaks about intention, he actually really got quite simple about it. Speaking about the intentions of kindness, the intentions of compassion, that are interwoven with the third wise intention of renunciation. That a path or a life rooted in these three wise intentions is a path and a life that's guided by integrity, that's guided by relatedness, and guided by freedom. And I know many of you in this room have been really cultivating this path of awakening for a very, very long time. And some of you are perhaps newer. But I think as we practice here and as we embrace this teaching and perhaps learn to trust in our own possibilities of profound inner freedom, it is actually very helpful and I think important to acknowledge that we are part of a renunciate tradition. That this is not something reserved for monastics or for those who have somehow, you know, divorced themselves from the world, from relationships, from people that they care about. That it is actually central to the whole path of awakening. Learning moment to unbind our hearts from confusion, from entanglement, from fear. Now, the path and the practice of renunciation, I think, is a path and a practice that leads very directly into a very deep understanding of the three universal laws, the characteristics of all that is born. Now, when the Buddha spoke about this, he was not speaking, the Buddha was not actually, I don't think he suffered from chronic depression. And he wasn't grim. But he actually really invited people to understand that freedom is rooted in understanding and aligning our hearts with the way things actually are. So he spoke very clearly about the three characteristics of all that is born, that there is unsatisfactoriness in life that asks to be understood. It's the unarguable reality of change and instability that none of us are exempt from. And he asked us to examine the question of self and non-self, to explore this, to understand this for ourselves. But coming back to this word, renunciation, I think for many people it is actually quite a difficult word to embrace. And it's certainly a challenging quality to embody. It can hold that kind of association of coldness and disconnection when I think we would all acknowledge how much our hearts really yearn for a greater sense of connection and intimacy with all things. Renunciation, I think, for when it's misunderstood, can almost feel counterintuitive, as if it's a way of non-caring. We acknowledge that we are relational beings, interacting with one another, loving and struggling with one another. And at first, renunciation seems to imply that we're kind of divorcing ourselves from relatedness. It implies almost getting rid of things. Apart from this world of associations, I think we probably all would acknowledge how very, very difficult it is, or does seem to be, to really let go of anything at all. When we look at our own emotional world, our psychological world, I think we see how embedded the emotional patterns, habit patterns, of clinging and grasping really feel to be in our lives. I mean, if you look back over today, just take one day, don't take a whole life. If you look back over one day today, and just trace the movement of clinging and grasping in a single day, how challenging or even how impossible it can feel to undo this habit. Looking back over today, how easily we find ourselves contracting around a thought, a sight, a sound, the idea of lunch, the last meditation that did or didn't happen, the thought about our future happiness, how often we find ourselves clinging to the people we love and to the people that we struggle with. It seems almost relentless, doesn't it? You know, the memories, the thoughts, the hopes, the role, the MySpace. And we could even really wonder what life would look like without clinging, without grasping. What would give us a sense of direction? What would get us out of bed in the morning? Would our life lack meaning? And it could look actually very fearful. I think it's so important as we reflect on this idea of unbinding the heart and the quality of renunciation to be really so crystal clear about what is actually being relinquished. Not people. Not our capacity for love. You're not relinquishing life. We're not learning or endeavoring to release a full and vibrant world of the senses. We're certainly not being asked to let go of our aspirations, our relationships, our capacity to care. When the Buddha speaks about renunciation, it's very clear. We're learning to relinquish the habit of creating and recreating contractedness and suffering and struggle. We're learning to relinquish the world of afflictive emotions, fear and ill will and confusion, so that the loveliness of kindness and compassion and wakefulness can really flourish. What we're actually doing in this path, if we call it a renunciate path, is learning to love the freedom of a heart unbounded. Now, in my experience, there's really no renunciation without understanding and without insight. That without understanding and insight, all that we have is a kind of command structure, often a kind of aversion. A world of shoulds, a world of trying to get rid of things, of trying to get out of things. And I think in this kind of system, we're not really letting go of anything at all. All that we're doing is rejecting and resisting and pushing away and avoiding. And these are the near enemies of renunciation. It's shadow side. I don't know of a single Dharma concept or quality that doesn't have a near enemy. And I think the near enemy or the shadow side of renunciation is basically walking away from or turning our back on all that we dislike or can't accept. In understanding renunciation, what we're really asked to understand, to put it very, very simply, is the way things actually are. Now, you hear this phrase a lot in Buddhist teaching, the way things actually are. It sounds almost like an ideological statement, you know, the way things actually are. But what is actually meant by this phrase is our capacity to align our hearts and to align our lives with the core actualities, what I describe as the unarguables of every human life. The unarguables of every human life. The unarguables of the kind of fundamental instability of our lives, in which there is loss, in which we do meet pain, in which there is discontent. Living in a life in which nothing stands still or is actually graspable. And living in a life and a reality where it's exceedingly difficult to find an enduring or reliable me. Now much, if we look really very deeply at much of the struggle and the turmoil and the confusion that we can and do experience, it's born not so much of these actualities or these realities. But what actually the confusion and the struggle is born of is our reaction to these realities. There is sadness in loss. There is sadness in aging. There is sadness often in uncertainty. But in our reactions to them, it is not about the sadness. It is about the kind of dissonance that we can create moment to moment in our life between the simple truths of this moment and the way that we actually want things to be. More than that we want things to be, the way that we try and insist upon things being how they should be. I think most of us would recognize that the dissonance, the gap between what the simple truth of the moment and our idea of how it should be, that that gap is actually an ocean of turmoil and often of tears. Now, renunciation, in my understanding, is actually concerned with healing this dissonance between the simple truths of the moment and our ideas about how it should be. And in healing that dissonance, I think it is a healing that brings to an end so much of the turmoil in our life, which is in truth optional. We go through our lives, we go through our days, and there is so much that is delightful. The beauty of a sunset, a lovely meal, being with people we care about, even on occasion quite a lovely sitting. There's the loveliness of being cared for. But there's also a good deal in most of our lives that's actually not so pleasant, that can be painful, uncomfortable, and sad, not getting what we want, the ways in which we can feel that our expectations are disappointed, whether it's about our meditation practice or our relationship or the fullness of our lives. We do meet difficult people. And, of course, for all of us, there is illness and aging. There is the painfulness of all the losses that we're asked to embrace in this life. This is a very personal reality. Each one of us feels this in some way. And each one of us in our lives is asked to respond to these realities with as much compassion as we can. But it's also a universal reality. If you look around you in this room, every single person in this room has, or currently is, or will be asked to embrace the landscape of loss and pain. In my life, I have really, this is something I've reflected on so much of late, I have really come to see that my relationship to both pleasure and pain comes to define me as a human being. Governs how I live my life and how I engage with the world. If I fear pain and only know how to react to the painful with aversion, my heart and my life will surely become agitated and contracted, and I will live with a waterfall of fearful thinking. If my reaction to pain is only one, or the unpleasant is only one of fear, I will endlessly be engaging in choices and actions that I can engage in to avoid the unpleasant. This is actually called grasping. This is called clinging. I can know deeply a capacity to appreciate the pleasant, to have my heart gladdened by the lovely, to delight and to appreciate. But I can also take the next step in relationship to the pleasant of clinging. Then I see that my wants turn to needs, and my needs turn to dependencies, and my dependency will solidify a belief in inner insufficiency. And I will also have a waterfall of thinking and also become agitated in that clinging. How do I maintain this pleasant? How do I have more of it? In fact, I may very well come to feel that my life will crumble if I don't succeed in maintaining and holding on to the pleasant experience, the pleasant sensation, or event. even the person I care for most deeply, will become, in the midst of clinging, become an object of anxiety. I think to understand this whole journey of freedom, I think we're all asked to explore the real foundations of clinging and grasping, and asked to explore, quite honestly, our own relationship to the pleasant and the unpleasant, to the delightful and to the painful. And I think this is a genuine reflection and investigation. It's almost like the kind of homework of our day and our lives. How does our relationship to the pleasant and the unpleasant define who we believe ourselves to be, as human beings, as relational beings? Clinging and grasping in this tradition, we're asked to understand, is only an intensification, a continuum of craving and aversion. It's not something apart. It's not something separate. It is only a continuum, a magnification, an intensification of craving and aversion. You know, you could see so many examples of this. You know, perhaps you're sitting here, maybe somebody has a bit of an unpleasant sensation in their knee or in their back. You know, perhaps there's a little bit of aversion. Perhaps your attention keeps getting drawn there. The sensation certainly seems to be growing, and so is my agitation. And you can feel, if I don't actually get rid of this, you know, I will probably die. You can just feel that intensification. You know, you may have found it in relationship to something quite lovely today, you know, a lovely sound. Oh, I really start enjoying it, you know, a little nice music next door, you know, the sound of a child laughing. Really quite enjoying it. Ah, I'd like a little more of this, you know. How am I going to keep this going? You know, maybe I need to take a trip to that music store. You know, maybe I need to do this. You can just feel that kind of intensification. Now, craving and aversion, of course, are speaking about our reactions to the pleasant and the unpleasant. And I think in our experience, most of us are really not short of opportunities to explore these reactions. It's not a demand that the reactions of craving and aversion don't arise. They do. But they ask to be understood and to be explored. What does it feel like? Really, to bring that question in for ourselves. Is there happiness? Is there peace in the midst of those moments when we feel held in the grip of either craving or aversion? Or is the nature of that experience by nature one of agitation? We need to kind of ask ourselves, when we find ourselves held in the grip of craving or aversion, is there spaciousness? Is there kindness? Is there compassion? We could take those questions, I think, into our day, into all the moments. When craving and aversion are arising, they may be questions that really help to calm and maybe even to interrupt the continuum of craving and aversion. And they may be the key of renunciation, of a heart unbound. It's part of a poem by Mary Oliver, some of you may know. And she says, every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal. To hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it. And when the time comes, to let it go. To let it go. Now, renunciation, I want to stress, is not something we do. It is an embodiment of an understanding of the universality, particularly of impermanence. The unarguable nature of change really means that nothing in this life is graspable. My own sense is that is our relationship to the reality of impermanence is the place for many people where there is the biggest dissonance in their life. It's a hard one. Now, okay, so we all know about it. Not news, is it? We all know about impermanence. We all know about instability. But do you notice how we can suffer these prolonged bouts of amnesia? We forget about it. Everybody in this room could have a deep and philosophical discussion about the reality of change. Isn't it also true it's so difficult for us to live in the light of impermanence and, most importantly, to embrace its implications? So, of course, sometimes we're really happy about impermanence. You know, the bell goes at the end of a sitting, root canal's over, difficult neighbor moves away, an obsession comes to an end. Oh, we are such fans of impermanence. Grasping is a reaction to the changes that we can't embrace. Clinging is a mechanism we use to pretend that impermanence and change will not touch all that we cherish, that somehow will protect us from loss. Now, change and loss can, in this life, really be deeply painful. It can cause so much heartache to be separated from those that we love. But it's true, and it's part of the fabric of all of our lives. Clinging is noticeably lacking, not only in resonance with the way things are, but it's often also deeply lacking in compassion and kindness for ourselves and for all around us. We tell ourselves that loss is a failure. Some people even tell themselves that illness is a failure. That separation is a statement of our inability to keep things fixed in place and somehow our fault. At times we cling to our fixed perception of others, of ourselves, and of the world around us. We say someone is a terrible person. I am an insensitive person. Someone is so cold. I am so uncaring or a failure. I can think of almost no greater act of compassion for ourselves or for another than to liberate ourselves and others from our fixed perceptions of them. To allow ourselves and others to be the fluid and unchanging beings that we are, filled with possibilities. The Dalai Lama, in teaching about impermanence, encouraged people to reflect on what has already disappeared. Might be youth, might be some of the interests that have engaged us in our life, some of the passions that have captivated us. Might be some of our energy has disappeared, our sense of capacity. Might be people we have loved who are gone. It might be the 10,000 experiences and events that once featured in our lives and that are now simply memories. Think of the tens of thousands of thoughts that have passed through your mind that are now gone. They reflect on the difficulties that we have met and experienced that are now part of our past. The variety of obsessions and preoccupations that may have governed our hearts and our lives at some point that are no longer present. The last thought, the last breath. It's gone. Some of this is gone, unhappily so, and some happily so, but gone. Imagine what our life would be like if this was not so. If we had successfully grasped all the events and experiences, thoughts, we wouldn't be able to bear it. Suzuki Roshi, he once said, renunciation is not getting rid of the things of the world. It is accepting that they pass away. Often seems that what is going on in our minds is that clinging and grasping is somehow essentially a kind of futile endeavor to deny the reality of change, to argue with the unarguable. We must see that whenever we're in a position of trying to argue with the unarguable, we are in a position of struggle and tension and pain, that it sets us at odds with the way things actually are. And so no wonder creates so much suffering. Now, what would it be like for us to truly, 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 deeply accept that all things will pass away? For me, it actually feels like a kind of grace. It doesn't mean that we love less or care less or appreciate less, but it might mean that we struggle less. In the midst of a mind storm that we are sure will last forever, a body pain that where we can see no end, or in a heartache that feels unbearable, to be able to deeply know in our bones that this too is a process that will change. It is a hard lesson for us to learn, isn't it? I think craving, aversion, and clinging feel like reflexes, don't they? It's like something just touches our consciousness and the reflex is there to either push away or take hold of or want more of. It feels like a reflex. It's so quick. The way that we see ourselves moving from openness to contractedness to clinging, it feels almost visceral. And yet our life keeps asking us to learn the lesson of unbinding. And this is no other lesson than learning to align our hearts with the way things actually are in a way to put down the argument. Even in the midst of sadness, there can be a deep knowing that the response to that loss, that change, that pain, the response that is truly compassionate is actually to embrace rather than to cling. Renunciation, I think, is also a very deep understanding of the reality of non-self. Again, this is something you've heard so many times. Non-self is not an ideological statement. You know, again, this is not an argument of self versus non-self. It's an invitation to investigate. Because what we really see that underlying many of our emotional and psychological processes, underlying many of our reactions and fears and striving, underlying many of the choices we make, there is a belief system operating. That this is me, this is mine, this belongs to me, this is who I am. And this is a belief system of fear. It's a belief system of insufficiency, an inner culture of lack that drives craving and aversion. I am my body, my past, my thoughts, my emotions, my roles, all that I've accumulated, all that I've become. We don't even know the power of this belief system until someone sits in my chair. Then I know it's my chair. Until we suddenly meet someone who voices a view so differently, so different than our own, then we hear that surge of selfing. This is mine. This belongs to me. The voice of clinging. Now, renunciation is not concerned with erasing the self. It's concerned with releasing the clinging to the view of self. Because I think we could be fairly certain if this most dominant underlying belief system is not questioned, then grasping has a license to continue to govern our life. Now, the view of self is also not emotionally neutral. Sometimes our view of ourselves is built around aversion. I don't like my body. I don't like my appearance. I don't like this experience. I don't like this emotion. We form a view usually expressed through judgment. I'm hopeless. I'm fearful. I'm a failure. I'm not good enough. This is sometimes the story we tell ourselves. Sometimes it's a story that's been told to us by others. Other times, the view of self is rooted in craving. Again, around body, around emotions, around thoughts. I'm a terrific meditator. You know, I always run the extra mile. You know, I'm hopeful. It is a view formed through clinging. The Buddha always left this as a kind of invitation to look at our own lived and felt experience and just to perhaps see, you know, I always think too much is made of kind of let go of, you know, of trying to teach about non-self. Personally, I think it would often be better to teach self. And to encourage people to go and sit on your cushion and go and do a walking meditation and go out into your day and find yourself. You know, I went to Asia, you know, when I was 17 to find myself. Must still be there somewhere. I never quite managed to breath. But to actually, when we really look, we see how difficult it is actually to find anything fixed of an injury. Do you remember your view of yourself when you were a teenager? Is it the same today? I hope nobody says yes. The sad self at breakfast looks nothing like the contented self overlooking the pool. You know, that it is, and of course there are views that linger. They seem much more convincing. They're not strangers to us, but just because we repeat a view more frequently does not make it more true. When we actually look at our view of self, actually what we see is the same impermanence, the same reality of change that permeates all things. We see process. We see thoughts, feelings, bodies, memories, perceptions, sensations arising and combining together in a mandala. And then what clinging does is to superimpose a view of something solid upon something that is changing. That is what clinging does. It superimposes a view of solidity upon something that is a process. It turns a verb into a noun. We go from selfing to me, to self. Now, what is actually taught in this tradition is to reverse that process, to go from noun to verb. Selfing is happening rather than I am. It is clinging that goes from verb to noun. Undoing the clinging is going from noun to verb. Now, what is quite extraordinary to me is that many of you actually have done this for a long time in this practice. You know, we see the process of selfing. And we see the kind of solidification of that process into something solid. And many of us have practiced for a long time, have at least come to have some agreement with the understanding that there is no fixed, enduring, centralized self. We may just have a glimpse of that. But what is so extraordinary in my mind, even though we actually see that in our own experience, we still shouted ourselves to let go. Now, the reason that that is extraordinary is that we can contemplate the process of selfing so deeply, know there is some truth, that there's no centralized, enduring, solid me in the middle of all experience, and yet somehow we imagine that still lingering inside here is some little autonomous me who's going to come forward at the right moment and let go. Then actually we see how much that idea of shouting at ourselves to let go is kind of nonsensical. Who would be doing that? Who would be doing that? Some other more enlightened me who kind of comes out at the right moment and lets go of the unenlightened me and the unenlightened me's activities? I think what the Buddha is actually... And so there's no wonder it doesn't work, by the way. You should feel reassured that your commands to let go have been unsuccessful. This is actually good news. Because it's actually asking us to look about why is that so. It's actually asking us to look a bit more deeply about why is it so that my commands to let go are futile. So, there's a different way of approaching this. We could begin to trace in our own experience the way that clinging is a continuum of craving and aversion. And that as craving and aversion actually become more solidified, there is actually that turning of that into clinging. Now, what we could say, or what we could say, actually the Buddha said it, is that craving and aversion are the conditions for clinging. They are the conditions for clinging and grasping and holding to arise. So then we could say, well, if that is so, what are the conditions for non-clinging? What are the conditions for unbinding? The Buddha put it very clearly, the conditions for unbinding, for non-clinging, are metta, compassion, equanimity, and insight. Now, I would ask you, this is not something odd in your experience. I'm sure everybody in this room has had the experience, for example, of a sitting where the mind is quite agitated, sort of quite aversive, you know, or agitated, and a difficult or a challenging thought or a sticky thought comes along, and you can feel the grasping. And I'm sure you've also had the experience, if we could. I'm sure you've also had the experience in a sitting or walking or another time in your life where actually the mind, the heart feels pretty calm, pretty spacious. Exactly the same thought appears, and there's no stickiness. It just passes on through. So what has changed there is not the contents of experience. What has changed is actually the climate of heart in which those contents are appearing. So what the Buddha suggested is that instead of going into these futile battles with craving and aversion and clinging, instead of all getting into this command structure of telling ourselves to let go, it is far more helpful to actually look at what are the conditions existing in the landscape of our own heart and mind, and what do those conditions actually lead to. So then we actually get into the acknowledgement, actually, that we're always practicing something. Every moment of our life, that we are practicing something, there are conditions that are being cultivated. So the real question in our day is actually, what are we practicing? What is being cultivated? We can begin to see in our own experience, if we cultivate the conditions of agitation, of confusion, of hatred, of ill will, we are cultivating the conditions of clinging and of struggle. If we more intentionally cultivate the conditions of calmness, spaciousness, balance, curiosity, kindness, compassion, We are actually cultivating the conditions of non-clinging. This turns this whole exploration of what we're doing here. In a way, it's a kind of change of orientation, I think, for many people in practice. Because I think particularly in Westerners, I mean, we all know, I mean, research usually tells us that the human mind tends to focus on what is imperfect, what is wrong. This was part of our survival as a species, not necessarily helpful today. When we are prone to focus on what is wrong, often our practice becomes an extension of that. So we're working on things. You know, we're working on the difficult. We're working on our issues. It is a complete, I think, for many people, a different orientation. An orientation that I think is actually at the heart of the Buddha's teaching is that we acknowledge what is difficult. This is helpful. But our actual focus is actually on cultivation, on what is helpful and skillful in healing and restoring. And that this is what takes care of the relinquishing, not me. Not me. That it is actually that cultivation of what is helpful that allows the unbinding of the heart. And this is not something idealized. This is actually something... It's about learning to liberate the moment. So you're learning about liberating the moment. I want to end with a part of a poem by Marge Piercy. Some of you may know it. Learning to love differently is hard. Love with the hands wide open. Love with the doors banging on their hinges. The cupboard unlocked, the wind roaring and whimpering in the rooms, rustling the sheets and snapping the blinds that thwack like rubber bands in an open palm. It hurts to love wide open, stretching the muscles that feel as if they're made of wet plaster, then of blunt knives and of sharp knives. It hurts to thwart the reflexes of grab, of clutch, to love and let go again and again. It pesters to remember the lover who is not in the bed, to hold back what is owed to the work that gutters like a candle in a cave without air, to love consciously, conscientiously, concretely, constructively. I can't do it, you say, it's killing me, but you thrive, you glow on the street. Like a neon raspberry, you float and sail through life. So thank you. If we take just a moment quietly together and then we'll have some time. Thank you for your attention. So we have a little bit of time now if there's anything you'd like to reflect on or have any questions about. Yeah. Trying to have a I mean, if you sort of gain any familiarity with some of the early texts of the lives of the ordained Sangha in the early years, it's pretty evident that the ordained life did not guarantee a renunciate life. And actually, if you spoke to any monk or nun today, you know, they would also be quite quick to tell you that, you know, changing your address is not a guarantee of liberation. What the Buddha did talk about as a practice, and I think this is, you know, because the Buddha didn't talk about renunciation so much as a practice, but as an understanding. But what he did talk about as a practice, and I think this really does apply both to lay and ordained life, is restraint. And I think restraint has been a kind of forerunner to unbinding and releasing. I mean, the truth is that most monastics, you know, they don't live in caves. They actually have pretty often quite full lives. But restraint is incredibly important. You know, I think it's very countercultural, but it is learning to put the pause button on, the pause button around the wanting the next thing, the leaning forward into what I don't have, the words that want to fly from my mouth, you know, the actions that feel reactive, the compulsions and the obsessions. I think restraint is a highly undervalued quality, because it is almost introducing that quality of intention into a field of impulse. And that you know, impulse are the places where we're most unconscious and most tend to suffer more. And I think if, you know, if we're going to take one practice into our life, it would be that one. And then maybe we actually look at what we do give time to, you know, what is helpful and what is unhelpful, what is skillful and what is unskillful, what is grasping and what is caring, and beginning to distinguish between them. And I think that's actually something that is really an intentional cultivation. Does that answer your question at all? I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that whole command structure of, you know, let go, let go, let go, is basically it's more in the near enemy of renunciation than renunciation itself. I think it's even more true when we tell other people they should let go of something, that it's generally in the aversive light of what we don't want them to be doing.
I'm very happy for everyone else.
No, I agree. I think it's when it moves into the shadow side.
Mm.
Yes, I think it's very important to notice that, no, really discern the difference between passion and clinging. You know, and I mean, we have many passions in our lives. You know, it might be a passion for music. A parent may have a real passion for, you know, caring for their child. You know, there can be many passions in our lives, and those passions can be a source of great joy, and they can be a source of great suffering. The one. And I don't think renunciation is about, you know, relinquishing the passion. It's being aware of where that turns into something else. You know, a view of self. You know, I'm the mother, I'm the musician, I'm the this, you know. And how actually that very turning into, you know, through clinging into the possession of a passion rather than the living of a passion. It actually really leeches the joy from that passion itself. You know? And it's the fluidity, you know. I mean, because we see the moment that the passion is turned into a role or an identity through clinging, it's kind of like takes the fluidity in our life. It gives us something to defend. It gives us something to protect or to assert, you know. I mean, it's like me showing up in the supermarket line and, you know, giving Dharma advice to the cashier, you know. It's like the passion gets turned into something that has to be asserted or defended, which actually really is a kind of disconnect from the passion itself. And it doesn't allow for the fluidity of responsiveness that, you know, in this moment it's this passion, in this moment it's another, something else is needed. And it's really actually learning that kind of fluidity, which is actually the alignment with the very nature of impermanence. Whereas the moment we go into the solidity of I am, we've, you know, disconnected from that fluidity and become that solid, and then the arguments begin. And, you know, the study of dependent arising, of course, is really the contemplation of how our world of experience is being constructed moment to moment. And when the Buddha talked about understanding the world, he was always talking about understanding the world of experience that is fabricated. And one of the primary kind of keys in that fabrication is that movement from craving and aversion to clinging and becoming. I mean, what comes to me is a phrase from one of the Tibetan lineages, actually from, I think it was from Shantideva, where, you know, he puts it that to care for others and neglect oneself is not compassion. You know, to care for oneself and neglect others is not compassion. And there is, you know, I mean, I think the Buddhist tradition often has a kind of a misguided or confused sense somehow of neglecting the body as a virtue, you know, where clearly that is not in the teaching. It was in the pre-Buddhist teachings, the kind of, you know, mortification of the body as a virtue. But it was, of course, one of the insights that the Buddha came across very early on. It was about what it means to actually care for the body as a vehicle for being able to embody that which we truly value. But where does that relate to the notion of clinging to life? I think it's used slightly differently in a different context. I mean, in the Buddhist tradition, you know, clinging is always within the realm of kind of unskillful tendencies, but it's used in a very particular context of something that leads to suffering. You know, I think in the English language it can be used in different ways, but it's differently contextualized. You know, so it's very, very important when you hear the word clinging, grasping used within the context of the Buddhist teaching, it's always only ever being used in the context of something that leads to suffering. So I think it's this different context. Yeah.
I think embracing life isn't suffering.
Yeah, embracing is very different than clinging. Anything else coming up? Thank you. Good night.